Hello everybody, my name is Ken Fallon and you're tuning in to the first of the live reports from Fostem. Joining me today is...
Dave Morris.
And Nido's around as well, we met him last night at the pub. We've just come to the first kickoff event, Welcome to Fostem, in what can only be described as a massive amphitheatre, I guess, lecture hall. And we're hanging around here for the introduction to the next talk, which I have no idea what it is. Dave is very organized and knows exactly what it's going to be. Keynote speech on?
It's How We Found a Million Style and Grammar Errors in the English Wikipedia.
How We Found a Million Style and Grammar Errors in the English Wikipedia. There are literally thousands of people here at this event, and there is Wi-Fi IPv6, and it appears to work. Doesn't work on the Android phones very well, but as the guy says, developers are going to fix that during the day. So, with that is the end of the introduction, and we will tune in later on for more live reports from Fostem 2014. Everybody, this is Ken. I've made my way down as far as the K building. K building, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And I've met up with?
Christoph Provost.
And Christoph, you're working in the cloakroom. What do you do for a living here? You're a cloakist?
I'm a freelance embedded software engineer. So I try to help people make their embedded thing work.
And how did you end up locking people's laptop bags and cloaks away?
It seemed like the best place to steal stuff.
No, excellent idea.
Yeah, seriously, I got called by the Fostem staff because I'd volunteered in previous years. So they called me and I was unable to resist the social pressure and the expectation. I volunteered to help them out again.
How many volunteers are there?
I honestly don't know. Lots and lots, but never enough.
Yeah, that seems to be the way, although it is amazingly well organized. This is my first time here and everything seems to be very, very smooth. Or is that just my misinterpretation of the chaos?
No, it mostly works because some of the organizers get deeply neurotic about things and they shout at people until things mostly work. Plus, it's not exactly the first time that Fostem is organized here, so most people know how things work.
Okay. And will you be here all day, or do you get a chance to go see any of the talks?
So everyone who volunteers gets to pick when they are available and how long they can volunteer. So I'm here until, I think, 4 today, and I pick up another shift tomorrow, but at the info desk.
Okay.
But everybody gets to volunteer, so if you want to see a certain track, you can volunteer to be on the video team or to introduce people in that room. So you're helping out, and you still don't have to miss any of the talks.
Yeah, all the talks are available online anyway, and links will be in the show notes to these episodes. But say somebody was coming here next year and wanted to volunteer, where did they kick off? Obviously, you know, they don't know anybody, they're new to the whole thing. How would they do that?
There is a web interface where you can sign up to volunteer, but I think it's probably easiest that you just come over to the IRC room, Fostem,
freenode.net.
Freenode, I forget which one. And just introduce yourself and say, I would like to help out, and then the staff will pounce on you and force you to do their bidding.
Okay, you're not making this sound very attractive, but hey. You obviously haven't seen any of the talks or anything yet. Anything you'd like to go and see?
I'm really looking forward to Paul Henningkamp's closing talk about NSA and spying.
Ah.
He's a great speaker.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much for taking the time. Uh, Hi everybody, this is Ken again. I'm still down in Building K, and I've come across the OS Geo booth, which is your open source compass. Hi Anna, can you tell me a bit about your project?
Sure. So OSGEO is an international foundation that is an umbrella organization for many geospatial projects. And we try to connect all of them because they are from various, they have various goals. So there can be libraries or desktop applications, web applications that are very popular, especially lately. We have local chapters that are localizing teaching material, organizing events all around the world.
Yeah.
And we have international events. Event each year is the Phosphor G, and you can check it. We try to make it around the world every 3 years, so once in the US, once in Europe, and one in Asia. And so we try to make it close to everyone so that everyone can join. And we provide hosting for the newly incubation for the new projects, so they have mailing lists and space for the version control system of the code. We try to organize events that connect them all together. And that's it. So we try to grow up and connect with all similar-minded organizations like OpenStreetMap that is next to us. So we provide the software, they provide the data. That's the kind of interaction we want to have.
And what sort of projects are under your umbrella?
We have both very young projects and projects that are from many years being developed, like GrassGIS, that is analysis software that takes geographical data and makes analysis on them. And we have also tools that make beautiful maps for the printing with all the styles you need. We have web mapping libraries that allow you to put nice maps and interactive maps on your website with simple code. And we have also initiatives that connect all these things together. So for example, we have the live OSGEO DVD that is a live distribution that contains all these OSGEO software and also some guest projects that are very interesting because they provide a lot of useful functionality. And we have educational goals. For example, we try to build a network of universities and research labs that provide open source, free and geospatial teachings and research material all around the world. And well, you can check on our website osgeo.org to see all the updates and all the news from all around the world. That's it.
Okay, very cool. So I'm looking here. What does this display show me here?
It's maps built by QGIS. This display shows a gallery of maps that are produced with QGIS. And the data are mostly coming from public sources that are now part of the bigger movement of the open data. And the rendering is done by QGIS itself. And if QGIS relies on libraries that are also open source, like GDAL, Prush, and just special tools, it's also bound with other software like RGIS that provides analysis.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you very much for the time, and links to all this information will be in the show notes.
Thank you very much.
And right next to Anna is Derek. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
And what are you here doing?
Well, I'm promoting also the OSGEO as an organization.
Yes.
And I myself, I'm the spiritual father of GeoMayas, which is one of the projects under the OSGEO environment.
And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I can. Well, in one simple sentence, if you want to create your own Google Maps environment, but you don't want to get stuck with a backend that you don't have control over, then you should look for an open source environment, and GeoMayas is just that.
But why can't I use something like OpenStreetMap or something like that?
Okay, because GeoMayas is a software, so we are focusing on the software infrastructure, and OpenStreetMap is data. So we are using OpenStreetMap data as one of the data sources that we can combine with other data sources, which can be private data sources from the clients using the GeoMayas framework, which can be governments or governmental agencies of businesses providing solutions to in the geo industry.
Okay, and when you say it's a framework, what do you exactly mean?
Well, it's a framework because we are providing an environment where people can create geolocated solutions without having to bother about every geographical specific things like mapping, coordinates, and whatsoever.
Zooming in and out and that sort of, yeah, okay. And it's a, you're talking specifically about software here. So what sort of languages do you support, or is it a particular language, or are we talking, are we on the code level here?
Well, Geomaya's framework is built on, is a Java framework. And we are even using Java for, we are using Java for the backend side, and it's a thin client frontend framework. And there also we are using Java and using the GWT toolkit or GWT from Google to transform that into JavaScript. So we only need one community of Java developers to support the technology.
Okay, and what sort of, you're from a company here, you're making an actual business out of this?
Well, I'm trying to make a business out of open source software. So I'm the spiritual father behind the Geomaya's framework. And I started a business which is focusing on providing professional services around that framework and technology. And I'm also making an ecosystem where people from the community can work into, and we are combining Geomaya's experts into projects so that that we can do bigger and larger projects, and that there is a single point of contact, which is GeoSpark, which provides these professional services.
Okay, and what's to say that, you know, if I go contributing code, that you won't just go and take it and...
Well, for one thing, we don't do that. We invested ourselves in the basic framework. So we provide that as an open source framework. You can use it. And you can, on top of that, build your own specific specialization, because Geomaya is a very broad framework. It provides very generic solutions into the geo industry. But now we are looking for partners in vertical industries, and they can invest themselves in software. And the thing that they have to do is provide their software as open source, because we are an open source project under the AGPL license. So they are obliged to donate also their code. If they don't want to do that, well, then they can use Geomaya's in a dual licensing way. And when there are partners that want to also work, and we have today a developer community, not only from our company, from almost 15 developers working continuously at Geomaya's. Well, when they want to use at the core, they agree to sign in a CLA, and in that way, we can provide these services to the community again and making money out of it. And it should be a win-win situation for GeoSpark and his partners.
Okay, and you're part of the GeoOS?
Yes. Well, we are part of OSGeo because, well, in OSGeo, only with one framework you can't conquer the world. And in OSGeo there are more than 20 different communities working on different several aspects of the geo industry. And it's what I'm as a person try to do is to combine the good things that there are in businesses with proprietary software with the good things that there are in open source businesses, and trying to provide opportunities that can change the world together with other people that are believing in open source. And to do that, you can't do that from out of a company. You should work together with other small businesses and companies and people who are committed to communities. And OSGeo is actually doing just that. It's combining different communities where different small businesses and independent developers and bigger companies providing software engineers into, so that we can talk freely about software, but also about solutions. And we want to bring open software one step further into the eco world.
Do you have an example of some project that you've already done that our community might be familiar with?
Well, one example is for the Ministry of Agriculture, who is maintaining millions of parcels for agriculturists, and they have a crowdsourced-based system where agriculturists can register their own information and their own assets and provide the tax information to the ministry. Other examples is in the digital, what they call digital building permits, to organize building permits and immediately provide also the geo information about the houses. Other examples are asset management for fire, disasters in Australia, for instance, where there were many fires last year. They have now a management system where governments can use that to create files for insurance companies. That are a couple of examples.
Okay, well, that's absolutely fantastic. There will be more information in the show notes, and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, everybody. Ken here again, and in the trio of mapping, we're at the OpenStreetMap booth. Not OpenStreetMaps, it's OpenStreetMap, I guess.
OpenStreetMap. You are? I'm Gael Musquet, I'm the chairman of the OpenStreetMap France local chapter.
And can you tell, for the one or two people on our network who don't know what OpenStreetMap is, can you just give a quick rundown?
Oh, OpenStreetMap is a wiki of map. So like Wikipedia, who is building an encyclopedia, we are building an atlas of the world with all data you can map. So you can have boundary, you can have trees, you can have station. In the station, you can have all amenity, all garbage collector, and so on. So it is a free maps and open maps, and you can use it, you can share it, you can sell it under the license ODBL, Open Database License.
And you do need to give credit, of course.
Yes, you can. You have two clause in the open database license. You have the share alike, so like in Creative Commons, you must share alike, and you have the paternity in this license. So you must say that OpenStreetMap is the source of one of your data.
Not too stringent a request. So why are you here at FOSDEM?
Oh, it is our fourth participation in FOSDEM in order to show what the OpenStreetMap community is doing, how we are working, and how we can build and improve the sustainability of the open source and geospatial information, and how we can work with other community like GNOME, like Mozilla, for example, and how we can build real open source geospatial services. There is software, but in order to make this software working, we must have data. And as governmental agency not give us data freely and open data, we must build an open source and maps of the world. So this is why we are here, in order to show our data. And we are also here to have the temperature of other communities, because there is a lot of community that already use our data, and they tell us here what they are doing with their data. And each year, it's really amazing to see how this project is really useful, is really bringing people new idea of a new way of to use and to collect data. And I meet some people from France here that I don't meet in France.
Yes.
It is really funny, and people say, I can't talk about this because my code is not really clean. And say, but show it. It's really nice what you have already done. There is a lot of people who can help you to improve your code, to improve your service, to improve your product. So it is a good start of point. We have a lot of campaign now in France, a municipal campaign So I have some people who are candidate to the municipal campaign, political campaign, who said, I use your data in order to make a Web 2.0 campaign. And I say, nice, it's really nice. This is another way that people are using data in political field. So if it is useful, use it. If it is useful, contribute and improve your city.
Absolutely. What is the state, you're from France, yes? What's the state of the map in France?
Oh, the state of the map is a huge conference of all the mappers of OpenStreetMap. So this year it will be in Buenos Aires, in Argentina, in November. And in France we have a state of the map. In April it will be 4, 5 and 6 of April. And it will be in Paris. So everybody can come, it's free, it's open, and the Paris region give us the place where they are deliberate, the laws and so on, the local government is seating, and it will be very, very, on Friday, it will be really nice because it is a huge proof of the sustainability of this community in France, and it is a great recognize of the Paris region president to our community and our work on the region to give us this great place.
Yeah, so that just to clarify for people who might know, you're talking about the local government of Paris have given you the parliament buildings.
Yes, all over Paris. So the most important region in France. So we will be there in April. So one day in the Paris region parliament, and the other 2 days it will be in Numa. Numa is a building by Silicon Sentier, who is a startup association. So we will be there for hacking, for discussing, for joking, and exchange with all the community and people who love us.
In the Netherlands, I live in the Netherlands. The maps are fantastic. They were very lucky to get a base map, and now you know things like post boxes and everything are mapped. Is that level of detail worldwide, or how is it in France? You know, can you use it to do navigation, for example?
In France, you can use it in grid town, a huge town. You have a grid accuracy. The French community is really, really, really active. So we have a lot of contributors. But if you are going in some rural towns, it's a little bit less detailed. You have
an opportunity to improve the map, let's put it like that.
Exactly. In other countries, like in Africa, for example, there is a lot of our contributors like Nicolas Chavin or Severin Ménard, who are some of the experts of the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team. These guys are bootstrapping community in Senegal, in Chad, in Ivory Coast, in Kenya, in Brazil, in Haiti. So I'm from the Caribbean, for example, and I'm bootstrapping also community in the Caribbean. So OpenStreetMap France can be one of the boats, for example, where we are trying to bootstrapping community and to make people to be in each of their countries independent of us, of course, because we give us materials, we give us GPS, we give us training, and afterwards they are continuing to mapping their countries because they are the best people to map, because they know their countries, they know their towns, they know their neighbors. So this is a great opportunity for them to start to map, in fact.
Okay. One thing that I'd like to know is, say I wanted to get into editing the map, what is the best place to learn about what a way is, what a street is, what an area is? Is there introductory videos or somewhere, some resource that I...
There is some tutorials. There is learnosm.org, who is a great tutorial, right in French, English and other languages. So it is a good point in order to start to learn of course. There is also mapping parties with some events we are leading in the community. So we have on the website, on the wiki, wiki.osm.org, a list of all events that are happening in the world. So feel free to join a group, a local group. In France, it is the last Friday of each month. In Paris and in other regions, also in southern France, there is a lot of meeting each month. So feel free to join one of these meetings and ask questions. Train yourself to contribute to OpenStreetMap. People will be very, very happy to receive you and to help you.
And if any of our listeners are going to one of those, can you bring a microphone and just record it for us here on the HPR network so that we'll be able to listen to it?
Of course, yes. You can follow us. And on the OpenStreetMap Twitter account, we have a lot of events that we are participating in. So feel free to join us and to record us and to...
Will do. Can you tell us about... we were talking earlier about these two devices. Yes. Can you give us a rundown on them?
Yes, we are...
has just come up and I'm taking over all the booth when you should actually be doing stuff. So tell us about these two.
Okay, so this is a board.
Photos in the show notes, by the way. I'll put photos into the show notes for this episode.
Okay.
So you can presume people can see it.
Okay. This is a module built around NV08C minus CSM with a firms who is building GNSS receiver, so you can receive GPS, we can receive Galileo, we can receive GLONASS signals.
And these are all, so that's the US version,
yes,
Galileo is the European.
GLONASS is the GPS from Russia, Galileo is GPS from Europe, it is not fully operational. So you have also Baidu from China, you have QZSS from Japan, you have a lot of constellations. So this module is able to listen to each of these satellites and give you an accurate position. Our goal is to use these cheap modules.
How cheap is cheap now?
It is less, the module itself is less than 40 euros. And if you buy all the boards, you have about 100 euros.
And how accurate is that?
So this board helps you to have submetrics.
So you mean accuracy tolerance,
yes,
is under a meter?
Submetrics and 2.5 meters. You are between 2.5 and 1 meters accuracy.
Wow, that's amazing.
So if you use two modules, you can build a differential GPS.
So, can you tell us what a differential GPS is?
Okay, differential GPS is the fact that you subtract the noise with another receiver. You have some perturbation, is the ionosphere, for example, that perturbate that the signal of the GPS and GNSS signals. So if you have one, if you have two receiver, you have one receiver who send this perturbation to the other. It make a subtraction, and you have a greater signal and other raw data that help you to improve your accuracy.
And how much can you improve the accuracy?
So with these modules, there is some works we have done with an Italian guy and some Japanese guy who built the RTK Lib with a free software too. And we have about 10 centimeters accurate all over the world.
So 10 centimeters.
Yes. So with less than 200 euros, you can build a network of GPS station. Real-time kinematic if you need it in real-time, or post-processing GNSS treatment, or processing, for example. So you record the two signals on your station and in your rover, so you are in mobility, in your car, on your bike, and all vehicle you have. And afterwards, you merge these two signals, you process it, and you have a trace or all the dots with a submetric accuracy and less than 50 centimeters accuracy, and we have in the best condition 10 centimeters accuracy.
That is phenomenal. That's something that they
has been criticized about the OpenStreetMap that the accuracy is never going to be as good as, you know, the Royal Ordnance Surveyors and not whatnot. Is there a way then to, when you're uploading your GFX files, is there a way to GFX?
GPX.
Thank you. To write in information about how accurate that trace is.
Oh, you can precise it in commentaries and so on. And in fact, more accurate trace, GPX trace we have, more accurate the map will be, because we will have reference for have good imagery to size correctly, because you can have shifting of the photography. So this type of trace helps us to have higher imagery correctly placed on the right place. So if you have some POI, for example,
point of interest.
Yeah. Point of interest, for example, the wall, a wall, a roundabout, a trees, a particular trees, or particular places, you can have the right place of your imagery.
So an aerial photographer could then use this more accurate to say that tree is definitely there, that tree is definitely over there. So those two points on that photograph can be cropped down.
Yes. So this is the first thing we can do. And afterwards, of course, trace streets, trace some entrance of station. Train station, for example, for people who are with wheelchair. If you have an accurate position of the door, afterwards you can go indoor and start to map the indoor of the rail station from the.
How many times the wheel goes around, for instance?
Yes, for example, we can map it if you photograph, if you take a shot of the plane. Of the rail station, for example, so you can place some amenities, some shop, and so on in the rail station, because we have reference outside of the.
So you take a photo of the plan of the building, you go to an entrance, get an accurate point there. You go to another entrance, get an accurate point there. Another exit, then you get an accurate point, and then you by that you'll be able to scale the image to be able to use it as a scale image, as opposed to. That is really cool.
So. We use all the ways, and this is a good point for Ordnance Survey. This is a good point for our Geographical Institute in France to tell them, keep it simple, stupid. We are really trying to have the best solution to have information. They are not so accurate or so complete that their data, but each time we find a new way, a new product, a new board, a new GNSS board, a new processor that helps us to improve our accuracy indoor or outdoor, or new imagery from drones, UAV, and so on, we help the community to innovate, and we help the world to have a new way to map for developed countries, but also for South countries. So if we are sending this type of GPS station for differential GPS in Africa, as it is really cheap, we can send more stations, and we can have more countries that can be mapped with a real accuracy.
Solution, yeah. What sort of device is this?
So
there's two devices here. There's like a plug-on board, which is a USB device, and presumably you put an aerial antenna on that. That's
radio,
dedicated for
the
GPS.
Interface.
Okay, gotcha.
And this is a great product from Olimex. This is guys from Bulgaria. You can go to the AW building. They are there.
Okay.
This is the first time.
Will do.
And this is the most open source silicon chip board. They will have a talk. It is an Arduino A10 processor. Yeah. So all these processors is reverse engineered. So you can run a Debian, an Ubuntu, NixBMC distribution on it. You have HDMI port, you have USB OTG, you have SD card, you have SATA port, you have battery ports, you have two USB ports, and you have network ports. So it is
wow. How much
open
is that?
Hardware. It is 30 euros. It costs 30 euros.
You're pissing. you're joking me. 30 euros?
Yeah, 30 euros.
Wow, cool.
This is just for 2 euros, and this is the A10 version. There is an A20 version with dual core, with more RAM too. Yeah. So you can go to the AW, and these guys are really, really amazing. They will talk about their works and their job, and this is a great demonstration. Our cell phones are give us a way to build cheap device, open source device, yes, with open source software, open source operating system. And this is a way for us to have some meteorological station, to have Thunderstrike station, you have GPIO, okay, and so on.
I'll talk to these guys separately. But so this device does, so I'm holding up the receiving device. That, you say, we were talking earlier, and you were saying that this can plug into any Linux machine, I'm presuming.
Yes.
And I could put this up in my attic and just contribute to a project. Can you tell me about that project?
Oh, there is a network built by the German people from a a geophysical laboratory.
Yep.
And they built a network of EntripCaster. So EntripCaster is a network of GPS, differential GPS, through the internet. So there is already GPS differential through radio, and this guy built a server, an open source server, that casting, streaming all the raw data from GPS through the internet. So you just have to go to the EntripCaster network and register your station. And say that on this URL, on this port, you are streaming raw GPS data in the Entrip format.
Yeah.
So it is really useful for, they already have a lot of stations in Europe and so on, but for example, agricultural, in the agriculture field, for example, there are big farms, and this is a good way for them to have this type of station, because that helped them to have a way to locate precisely where are the orchard, each trees, and so on. So for us in France and in other countries, the goal is to build an international network, cheap network of EntripCaster all over the in Africa, in Caribbean, and to have a way from governmental sources, but also from citizen sources, to have real, great, and accurate GPS position.
Okay, just correct me if I'm wrong. So I would have a server running anyway, and I decide to plug in one of these highly accurate devices, and I'm streaming that to the internet. So then that would mean anyone going around with another one of those devices, or a device similar to that, capable of picking up the stream in a region around my location, would be able to benefit from a more accurate map. But then as they move further away from my location, the accuracy would decrease, obviously.
Yes.
But then hopefully there'd be more people.
So it will be more precise if you are doing real-time kinematic positioning. But if you want to have post-processing, you can save the stream locally, to save the stream on your server too, because the server is saving the stream, and afterwards download the same stream at the same times, but in two places, different places. And more stations you will have on your cities, more accurate will be your post-processing.
So this will be something for local governments in each of their buildings around the city to have this, and then that would allow the community then to get more and more accurate, detailed information down to like very high tolerances.
Yes, as we have this type of network for meteorological station, we have this type of network, for example, also for quake chasing network. We have SETI at home, for example. We have Folding at home. We have this type of project you can distribute and calculate and so on. We have this same type of community of people who are deploying on the roof of their house, of their office, of the local government building and so on. This type of station of cheap and as cheap as we can station. So we will have more and more and more station and more accurate stream, and more accurate position, in fact.
Okay, I've taken enough of your time. You need to talk to the people here at FOSDEM. Listen, thank you very much, Hal, and look forward to following your progress here.
Okay, you're welcome.
Hi, this is Ken, and we're at the K building, and I've just come up to the Libra Graphics table, and I'm going to talk to Ginger. How are you doing?
I'm very good. How are you?
Not too bad. Can you tell me a bit about what your table is? What's Libra Graphics?
Absolutely. So we're Libra Graphics magazine, and we're a print publication devoted to showcasing good work done with floss in graphic design and art.
And in this day and age of actually killing trees and stuff and everybody having EPUBs, why have you decided to go for physical print media?
You know, we find that having a print magazine instead of just a digital one, A, gives us a sense of legitimacy, and B, also makes us a sort of record, right? And something that you can share more easily. You can show it to someone and say, look at this awesome thing I just saw.
And when you say, okay, tell me why, what is it? What's the point?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we've always heard, so the three editors of this magazine, we're all trained as graphic designers, yeah. And we all first trained using Adobe, right? Oh, yes. And so one of the things that people always say in Floss is that Floss graphics software is fine for the web and it's fine for hobbyists, but it's not good for professional work or for print work. So we try to show people that it is.
Yes, I think I've heard you on another podcast.
Linux Outlaws, maybe? Yeah.
And how many publications have you got at this point?
So we've done 6 official issues. We actually started in May 2010 with something that we call Issue Zero, which isn't in our catalog now. It was a sort of limited run, 200 issues, or 200 copies, yeah. So since we started officially, we've done 6 issues.
Okay, and how much is it, and where is it available?
Well, you can buy it from our website, and at FOSDEM, it's a little cheaper than online because we don't have to ship it. So online, I think we charge, $16 to ship it within Europe, for a copy within Europe.
Yeah.
And then a little bit more if you're shipping it elsewhere.
That seems to be about right for what a magazine subscription would be.
It's the cost. Well, that's per issue, but it's the cost of a normal magazine, right?
For yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Definitely.
No, I knew that because yes. They. In the Netherlands, you can expect to pay up to 20 quid for a Linux magazine.
Totally. Yeah, well, then that's the thing. We cost about the same as a regular art magazine, right? Or a regular specialist magazine.
Okay. Talk me through one of your issues, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah. So our most recent one, which we call Gendering Floss, just came out this week. We're actually releasing it at FOSDEM. And because all of our issues are thematic, this one is about the issue of gender in free software.
Okay.
And so we're very interested in discussions about what it is to be, you know, a man or a woman or other in a Floss community.
Yep.
So we have some stuff from, you know, we have a new releases section, which is standard. We have some columnists who are addressing the issue of the magazine. We have a really nice piece from a group called Hacker Moms, which is in California, and they're a set of women who find that their relationship to the world has changed when they become mothers,
yeah.
And so they started a hackerspace for mothers. We have a nice showcase, actually, and this is where, you know, buying it is great because
I must say the quality looks absolutely stunning.
We are designers, so our showcase this time is about gendered craft, so about knitting, about embroidery, about things that are sort of traditional women's work, and then about Coda's craft.
Okay.
Yeah.
And all of this is produced with free software.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is.
So, like, for what example? I'm thinking the game, Inkscape.
Yeah. Well, so for layout, we use Scribus.
Yes.
We definitely use Inkscape. We use GIMP. But we also do version control.
Yeah.
So all of our working assets are actually available in our Git repository. You know, we use IRC. We use mailing lists. We operate like a Floss project, but we happen to be publishing a magazine.
And do you have is it a for-profit company or
how is your company made up? Do you have a company, or is it just these three guys?
We're pretty ad hoc. One of the things that we want to do in future, once we get the money to pay a lawyer, is incorporate as a non-profit.
Could you not go as an umbrella under one of the...
We would love to, if anyone would take us on.
Ah, why don't they want to take... I sense that there may be a little issue.
No, it's not that no one wants to take us on. It's that for us, the major issue is putting out the magazine. And so a lot of the administrative stuff falls by the wayside. So if we had the time to approach, say, GNOME or the Free Software Foundation or one of those nice umbrella groups, you know, that would be great.
But... Or if one of our listeners could... was experienced enough, they could maybe get in touch and give you a hand. So that is, can you just give us the URL again for the crack?
So the magazine is at librographicsmag.com.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks very much. Hi everybody, this is Ken again. I'm at the OpenSUSE booth and I'm going to talk to Richard Brown. How are you, Richard?
I'm fine, how are you?
I am not too bad, enjoying the show.
Good.
And you're stuck here at the booth?
Not stuck, no. I'm actually quite enjoy it. I do it every year for OpenSUSE at Foston.
Do you work for OpenSUSE? Or do you work for SUSE?
I work for SUSE as of 2 months. So for the last 10 years, I've been doing OpenSUSE as a community member. Now I'm working for SUSE as well as QA, but the...
There you go, folks. You contribute to a project, eventually they'll pay you.
Yep, eventually they'll pay me, yeah.
So tell us what a day at FOSDEM feels like for you.
For OpenSUSE, it's, you know, normally starting early. You know, we try and have FOSDEM as our sort of biggest event of the year, apart from our own. Taking the booth up, we try our best to sort of show off our new merchandise and most importantly, show off our distribution.
And what is your distribution?
Our distribution is OpenSUSE 13.1 at the moment, which is sort of the latest and greatest of everything from every upstream project which we listen to, which I think something like 5,000 packages are now in our main distribution. Okay. It's getting really quite large. We're spending a lot of time figuring out new ways of integrating and releasing this stuff as quickly as we want to, while actually still drawing from all these different upstream projects. So we have lots of, behind our main distribution, we have a lot of sort of interesting sub-projects like our open build service, which, you know, I'm trying to remember the Ubuntu equivalent, Launchpad, which is sort of like our Launchpad, but then with a really powerful, clever build engine behind it, so we can take one package and build it for all of our distros and everybody else's distros as well.
So that's, you also build RPMs and Red Hat RPMs and Debian
RPMs
Debs.
And Debian Debs. And we like when other projects are using it as well. Guys like the OwnCloud project do all of their building on our build service, and then they actually use our infrastructure to give everyone your download packages.
And do you need to pay for that distribution service?
No, it's all very gladly sponsored by SUSE.
Okay, very good.
But if you want to sponsor us, the OpenSUSE project is interested.
And what is the relationship between the OpenSUSE project and SUSE itself?
Surprisingly independent. So, you know, with a name like OpenSUSE, there's often a perception of, you know, SUSE control it, whereas in reality, it is an independent project very closely sponsored by SUSE. So the board is independent, a five-person board, which can have no more than two SUSE employees on it.
Okay.
So, you know, we have two SUSE employees, an ARM employee, and, you know, two other community members who I can't remember now. The project is very closely sponsored, but in terms of technical direction, project direction, it is a community effort. You know, we very much believe in the idea of those who do decide. So if you are a community member working on something, you know, it's your call to get it in the distro.
And who owns SUSE now?
Who owns SUSE now? The attachment group owns SUSE now. So they're a group that contains SUSE, Novell, Attachmate, and NetIQ. All run as completely independent business units. So separate management, separate staff, but with shared services between them.
For a lot of people, the whole attachment was a very strange company to take over. How did that go down with the OpenSUSE community?
It hasn't really impacted us directly much. The biggest thing you've probably noticed is the sort of corporate culture change in SUSE has made it a lot more how OpenSUSE wanted it to work anyway. So the the open source philosophy is much more embedded in SUSE than it was when it was Novell/SUSE. So yeah, that's okay.
So a bit of a distillation away from the Novell
side. Yeah, SUSE is now a separate business unit with a separate corporate culture, separate management, etc. So it's very easy to be very different from Novell while still at the heart of it, you know, sharing things like finance and infrastructure.
Okay, there might be quite a lot of listeners actually who might not know what SUSE is as a distribution.
Yep.
Can you give us a quick rundown what your target audience is, what you do?
The target audience for OpenSUSE is pretty much anybody interested in open source. You know, we kind of target that sort of core enthusiast hacker bit very, very nicely. We want it to be stable, we want you to be able to work with it. But at the same time, we always sort of like to stretch the limit on cutting edge. So we won't put something in there that's outright broken, obviously. But, you know, we're always upgrading to the latest version of our various upstream packages, the latest GNOME, latest KDE. If it's stable, we include it. And that's kind of the role that OpenSUSE takes. So from SUSE's corporate perspective as our sponsor, we fit a role for them very similar to Fedora's.
Yep.
But because of the difference in how open OpenSUSE is, maybe with a bit less of direct control that Red Hat, you know, have over.
I don't think Red Hat make any bones about the fact that they're using Fedora to steer development.
Yeah.
Whereas you're saying,
whereas the OpenSUSE relationship is much more SUSE let OpenSUSE go its own direction. Perfect example being the default choice of desktop. The default choice of desktop for OpenSUSE is KDE.
Yeah.
We include GNOME. I actually work on the GNOME team. It's a perfectly equal partner. But the default, if you're installing an OpenSUSE disk, is KDE. Whereas on SUSE's Linux distributions, it's currently GNOME.
Yeah.
They have no bones of going, okay, you know, OpenSUSE's SUSE's upstream, and then downstream for their enterprise distributions, they pick something entirely different.
Okay. And what other choices of desktops do you have?
Our current collection of sort of main desktops is GNOME, KDE, XFCE, LXD, and Enlightenment.
Okay.
Whereas we have other side projects and other community projects where they're adding things like Matter and other ones as well. So.
Do you
have the build service, you can pretty much just add whatever you want to that, and then it'll build for OpenSUSE. So.
So rather than having PPAs, you put it into the build service?
Exactly.
Thank God.
Yeah.
I've spoken, and this has nothing to do with the interview, but
no, it's fine.
I've spoken about this before, that you know, RPM hell is what PPAs are going to be for people. They're going to get their butts burned.
The model of OBS, the Open Build Service, is... it's constantly evolving. We're constantly trying to improve it, but we very much avoid the whole sort of...
Okay, tell us what the Open Build Service is then.
The Open Build Service, it's sort of a hybrid between Launchpad and PPAs. So it's where we do all of our...
I've got an application. I want a package for everybody. I'll upload the source code up there, and then...
And then it will automatically build for the distributions you've targeted. And then once it's built, the Open Build Service will host that as an RPM repository or a dev repository for all of your users to use.
So I could then add that into my sources.list in Debian.
Yep.
I'm going to a SUSE repository and get my...
That's just weird. It's weird, but it works. I mean, we're an open source project. That's, you know, part... It's, you know, we've got this great technology. Why shouldn't we share it with all the other distributions?
This was collaborative something.
Yeah. Yes. All that stuff. And in fact, it's really helped with a lot of the collaboration we've done with the Fedora guys and Red Hat. You know, a lot of we're finding a lot of really nice benefits with things like just basic RPM packaging, because they're doing things and we're doing things in a way that we both understand much more now. So a new bit of software comes out, we're getting that spec file built way quicker than we used to. And you know, when crazy upstream stuff changes happen, it's having much less of an impact on us, which is great because we've got 5,000 blooming packages in our main distribution there and growing.
So if you're a small software, you have like widget X software uploaded up there, and then instantaneously it's available to all the other projects.
Yeah.
That's just phenomenal.
And then when it fails, you get a decent build log from that server, because it's all done in VMs, of why it failed, how it's failed. So it's great to start debugging it and messing with it there.
I think one of the most the reasons people use OpenSUSE, in my experience, has been Yast.
Yes.
And one of the main reasons people don't use OpenSUSE
is
Yast. Can you tell me about Yast? What is Yast?
For 10 years, I totally understand that. So Yast is our system administration tool. Yes, another system administration tool. That's what the
Badaboom,
brilliant. Yeah, and it tries to be this nice central control panel for every conceivable aspect of looking after your installation. So it's what we use as our installer. It's our Anaconda equivalent. And it's very, very modular, so things like Apache management and, you know, all the other services, firewall, etc., all in there, all controlled in Yast. Historically, in the past, and speaking of the sysadmin, I have been burnt by this. You know, having a lovely administration tool is great, but then when you want to go under the hood and start messing around with things like config files, you're going to start getting conflicts. You know, you modify a config file, Yast comes along and undoes your edits or just breaks everything. Yeah. That was the past. It's been 3 years now since I've had any problem with that. The way that our YAF teams have worked now is very much, it will either merge those changes very, very elegantly, or YAF will pretty much keep its hands off and know that the sysadmin has touched that. And both my experience and OpenSUSE and internally at SUSE, we don't see these sort of Yast hell issues that we used to.
And that would be considered then a bug if I, for example, added another virtual host in Apache and it didn't appear, then that would be a bug.
Totally, yeah. And I actually, my personal servers now, I am actually using Puppet modules to modify files directly, and yet that is still compatible with Yast, so Yast is actually ending up reading something that's coming from a totally foreign source.
Interesting.
No modification in Yast required.
That's fantastic, actually. That might make me have another look at OpenSUSE.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Anything else that I missed in this whole journey? What's the beer tickets?
Well, yeah, our conference this year, every year we have our own conference. So this year, OSC 14 is going to be in Dubrovnik. We're giving away free beer tokens. So if you turn up there, you know, hand over your one Geeko money and get yourself a free beer in Dubrovnik.
After being at the pub last night, I can your target audience very well.
Well, yes. In previous years at FOSDEM, we actually have a brewery near the office in Nuremberg that actually makes OpenSUSE branded beer. This year, we decided not to bring it because it got a little bit crazy last year. We know our target audience.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much. No problem. Appreciate the interview. And this is Ken again for Hacker Public Radio. We're down at the Debian booth, and I've just pulled somebody away from beating up an OpenSUSE guy who are next to us. And your name is?
Joost van Baal Illich.
And you're from?
The Netherlands.
And you're here with the
Debian? I'm selling Debian t-shirts.
And is that all that the Debian booth is? A commercial, a way to generate revenue for the Debian project to have world domination?
Debian makes an operating system, but I suppose your readers knew about it.
Well, I think probably everybody knows about it, but can you give us an idea of what Debian is and where it started? And
okay, Debian is something like 18 years old, I believe. It's an open source Linux distribution. So it's one of the old ones. Ubuntu is based upon Debian. And we're a global community of about 1,000 hackers. And we take the Linux kernel and free software tools and combine them into an operating system.
And are you a developer for Debian?
Yes, I'm a developer for Debian, yes.
And what packages do you maintain?
Well, they're mainly interesting for system administrators. I work as a system administrator and I package some tools I use in my daily work.
Okay, cool.
And I help doing publicity, selling t-shirts, stuff like that.
And why did you come to FOSDEM?
Oh, I'm a FOSDEM regular. I think I was also at OSDEM, the first edition about 10 years ago or something. I love it. It's a grassroots thing. It's a really community-based conference. It's huge, it's international. It's beautiful. I really love it.
And why would you... this interview is all over the shop. It's nothing new for me. But why would somebody come... Why would a user install Debian instead of Ubuntu, for instance?
I think Debian still has more of a grassroots atmosphere around it. It's made by the hackers. There's no commercial entity behind the distribution. And people come together and work on the operating system. Not because their boss tells them to or they're employed or whatever, but because they want to do it.
And what is your relationship with the Ubuntu teams?
fine. I'm happy. I'm happy Ubuntu exists because it. I think it really helped also Debian getting more popularity and more people are. I mean, Ubuntu is basically a large part of Ubuntu is just plain Debian. So more people run Debian software, and I like that. So I'm happy about that. Yeah.
And why are you selling T-shirts? Where does the money go?
The money goes to some foundations who are the. Official institution behind Debian. It's the foundations who basically collect money, and if people want to travel to meet other hackers or go to conferences, you can get your travel costs reimbursed. So in order to cover that cost and also cost for hosting, the profit we make from the t-shirts goes to that these costs.
Okay, and the t-shirts are actually excellent. Okay, that's cool. There's a t-shirt with Swiss flag on it. Cool. Completely distracted. So what have you got here? You've got some CDs?
I can tell you about the t-shirts. Yes. I used to print t-shirts myself.
Yeah.
So I'm in the Netherlands and I went to a print shop and downloaded the Debian logo, printed the t-shirts, sold them here, and the profit went to these institutions, if you make any profit. Because I think a lot of t-shirts are usually sold for cost price, so the profit is almost nothing. But yeah, people love them. We are here each year and we sell huge amounts of t-shirts. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And people want to wear a Debian t-shirt because they love Debian and they want to show it to the people. So
The logos are the designs on the Debian t-shirts always seem to be fantastic. Who comes up with them?
Well, we have the Debian swirl, which is the logo. And
I know that's fairly boring, but like they you had the a few years ago, I think the green one with the Heineken logo with the Debian on it.
Yeah. I think the Grosch one is made by Steve in the UK, and I think he just liked the idea, and he mixed the Debian thing with the beer brand. Yeah, it's just anything goes. People come up with ideas and they print them, and they got them sold.
So what is the what's the state of Debian at the minute? What's anything coming up? Anything new that we should know about?
We're working on a new stable release as always, which is. I'm not supposed to say that. We'll ship it when it's ready. That's
obviously,
our
yes.
motto. More the technical people are more interested in technology, might be interested in a debate about whether we're going to ship with systemd or upstart.
Yeah.
There's a really big debate going on. What will be the default init system on the operating system? So we'll see what comes out. What else?
Why is there a need to change? What's wrong with init?
System 5 init. That's the old one.
Just being old, why does that make it in any way worse?
Being old doesn't make it worse, but it has just less features. I mean, the new ones have more features, and they're. I think some things within the way systemd init is implemented are just buggy. If you want to have an init system and you want to reliably start and stop daemons, then you shouldn't do it as it's now being done. It's really broken. And so people are trying to fix it, but the migration costs are huge. So a lot of people are hesitating about really changing their systems and switching to a new init system. Okay. So that's just because the migration is so tough, that's why people still stuck with system 5 in it.
Okay, yeah. And no sign as to which is going to be which?
Sorry?
There's no decision yet as to which is going to be chosen?
No. I think on Monday the Debian Technical Committee will vote on something.
And you're also changing your default desktop, or is that just a vicious rumor?
Oh, yeah. systemd is... GNOME depends upon systemd. So if you want to run a GNOME desktop, then you kind of have to have systemd, unless you want to go to real pain. So at one point in the debate, somebody said, let's just drop GNOME or ship with a default another desktop environment. Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't use GNOME. I don't use any popular desktop environment. So for me personally, it doesn't really matter. We'll see what comes out. I don't know.
These things are all. Yeah. It's a very democratic process. The Debian community.
Yes.
And I don't know if the listeners might not be aware. Can you tell me about what the DPL is? And
okay, so yes, Debian is a duocracy, as they say. But still, it's nice to have a role, to have a project leader, because, for instance, if you have a president of you, well, we have a president of you now. I'm not the DPL. It's nice to have one person representing the whole project. So that's basically why we have a DPL. And sometimes we have technical debates which are so tough that we can't decide. And so we have some infrastructure to smoothen the decision-making process. But generally, most decisions are just, well, people just build something which works and which attracts more people, and then it turns out to be the default. That's basically the way it works. But yeah, but for instance, in that system, it's not possible to do it like that. So we have a technical committee who are a bunch of experienced Debian developers who are supposed to know what they're talking about, and so they can make a decision. We can, the Debian developers as a group, can ask the technical committee, please decide upon this, because we can't go on flaming each other for 5 years. So that's what happened with the init system. But now there are also people saying, yeah, maybe we should have a vote, because in Debian the developers also have a right to vote. And for instance, we vote for our new DPL, but we can vote upon anything. Any developer can say, we should vote upon this. Please tick one of these four boxes, and then ask other developers to support this idea that there should be a vote, and then there will be a vote. So maybe there will be a vote among the developers which init system to run.
So what makes Debian different from, say, OpenSUSE or Red Hat or any of the other distros?
Oh yeah. Well, I'm a system administrator, so I look at the thing from a technical point of view. And Debian has the .deb packaging format, which I think is superior to RPM. OpenSUSE and Red Hat both use RPM.
What about software philosophy, your choice of software packages?
Well, I think Debian ships the most. But yeah, you could also, Debian ships a lot of stuff that nobody uses. That's also true. So, yeah, it just depends on what you want. And but I myself, I feel also at home in Debian, in the Debian community. It's both a software project, but it's also a group of people who like each other and who meet, and it's all social network.
There's been some criticism leveled at Debian that you're not in free distribution.
Oh.
By the Free Software Foundation.
Ah, okay, yes. Yeah, we have some debates with FSF about this. I think in the very early days, Debian started as an FSF project, actually. But that's a long time ago. There still is this issue about the GNU, Debian people would say the GNU not so free documentation license. So the GNU free documentation license, which is considered not Debian free software guidelines free by Debian. And FSF probably, of course, thinks differently about that. And there were some other issues I forgot. I can't think of them now. So yeah, I mean, if you're really into this nitpicking, then you can have a real interesting time framing people and making a big fuss about it. Yep. But I think generally there's way more connecting the FSF with Debian than splitting the FSF from Debian, in my opinion. But
And do you have any developer conferences, or where can people? How can people get involved if they were interested in Debian?
Well, they can meet us at the booth, of course.
Yep.
And there, I think there is some distro room, cross distro room.
Yep.
I don't know for sure. There's one place where Debian specific talks are being given.
Okay.
So there's a track about this.
And you have Debian conferences around the world as well.
Yes.
Do you ever attend those?
Yes, we have DebConf since a couple of years, which is your yearly conference. It's year in a different country. I've been to a couple of them. It's really nice.
Do you have a kilt?
No, I don't have a kilt. Yeah, the kilt is not really connected with DebConf, but a bit. Yes, yes. The kilt are pretty expensive actually, but they're really nice.
Yes,
it's
they are.
Really nice. Yeah. So.
Okay, cool. Listen, I'll let you get back to the selling t-shirts and improving Debian. And thanks very much for the interview. I'm here at the Google Summer of Code table, and probably everybody knows about Google Summer of Code by now, but I'm here with two people who partake in the Google Summer of Code. You are?
I'm Martin Jitski.
I'm Jakub Permas.
And what are you here talking about today?
Today we are presenting our operating system project, which participated in 2 previous years of Google Summer of Code.
Okay. And what's it called?
It's called Helenos.
And what does Helenos do that sets it apart from all the other distros that are out there?
Well, if I have to think of anything particular, it's written from scratch. It's not trying to be compatible with the existing operating systems, and it's multi-platform.
And what does that mean, actually?
that it is multi-platform. That means that we support from 7 to 8 different processor architectures. And regarding that thing about not being compatible with the existing systems, it's probably best expressed by saying that we are not trying to be a better Linux, because the best Linux out there is Linux itself. And instead of that, we are trying to focus on designing software in a simpler way, maybe sometimes in a better way, which gets rid of some of the bloat that you get when you port libraries and other software components from third parties.
So if I was asked, if I was tasked either of you, what the difference would be in packaging between HellenOS and Debian, for instance, what would your reply be?
Well, my reply would be that it's an undefined question, because we don't have any mature packaging at all. It's the goals of the system are totally different. So the goals of Debian are probably linked to its end user usability, to be able for you to make your stuff, make your work on the system. Our goals are more tied to the operating system itself, to really rethinking it, redesigning it in a way that might allow you to build and usable operating systems in 20 years that will be more reliable, more dependable and more secure than the current operating systems. But our goal and our limited manpower cannot allow us to create an end-user usable system, but we want to create an perfect operating system.
And what's your definition of perfect then?
That's complicated. And
we have all the time in the world, or at least until FOSDEM's over.
Well, I have mentioned some of the criteria. So we want to be.
Do you use a Linux kernel for a start?
No, we have implemented and designed HellenOS or HellenOS completely from scratch. So our microkernel is written from scratch. Our user space is written from scratch. And we have several design principles that we try to follow, like being a microkernel system, using small-grained or fine-grained user space components, uh-huh, so that there is a possibility for formal verification of them. Or easier formal verification of them, and this leads to the goals. So we want to be more dependable, more secure, easier to be formally verified, and well, generally speaking, a better operating system.
Okay, fair enough. So, what sort of license is this whole release on? Let's start with that.
Yeah, that's easy. It's I think it's 100% BSD license, the three-clause BSD license.
And where is the project hosted?
Well, it's hosted on Martin's infrastructure, and because we are using Bazaar as our version control system, yep, we host some of our branches on Launchpad.
Okay, and what is it written in? What language?
The kernel and the user space components are written in plain C. Obviously, some parts of the kernel, especially, are written in the assembly language of the respective processor.
How many people are working on this project?
Let's say that the core team, the core developers which contribute to the project regularly, has the size of 10 people. But there are like less frequent contributors. Or occasional contributors. So again, depending how you count it, it might be as far as 50 people in total.
Yeah, I think I've done these statistics about 2 years ago, and I included the students that worked on HellenOS as part of their master thesis, and also the Google Summer of Code students and the random contributors. And the number was around 45, and if we add the additional 2 years, I think it's, as Martin said, 50.
So it's unlikely that I'll be able to go to Firefox and install Firefox on this. How far along are you now to a usable desktop? Or is that the goal, a desktop, or is it a... What is the goal, or is it should it be up to the individual?
it should be a general purpose operating system. So the desktop is as important goal as an embedded system. So we don't want to be biased in that. And when we should speak about the practical usability, we have a web server. We still like a web client, a web browser.
We do have a download utility which works sort of like the wget application.
Okay. And is it your intention to bring in other applications to share code, or are you thinking this is more philosophical approach that for your desktop or for your project you want code only coming from your project?
In the end of the day, I think porting, for example, a web browser, an existing web browser, is a necessity because we don't have the manpower to implement our own, and it would be probably foolish to implement our own web browser. But a web browser is not a core component of the system, so it's just one end user application. But in that case, we are not opposed of porting applications from other systems. But we don't want to port the core components from other systems. So the core components, the components that create the foundation of the system, should be Helenos native.
Okay, and so describe how far you are already.
So we have already spent some 12 years on it. We started small and only gradually were able to attract interest of other people. So what we already have, working kernel, which supports everything else. We have a file system layer with support for multiple commonly used file systems, such as extended 4, Minix file system, the CD file system, UDF, you name it. We also have fully decomposed, and I think we were the first in the world to have it, a fully decomposed networking stack.
What does that mean, fully deep?
Yeah, let me explain that. Normally, the networking stack is either part of the monolithic kernel, yeah, or even in case of microkernels, it will be implemented as only one component, meaning that it runs in one process.
Yep.
So
monolithic component.
It's either a monolithic component in the kernel or a monolithic component in the user space. But not so much, or not like that in our case, where we have decomposed it into many different processes. So we have a different process for TCP, a different one for UDP, different one for IP. So there are about like five different processes that together implement the networking stack.
And why is that a good thing?
Well, if you imagine that your UDP server crashes, it doesn't take down the whole system, and it doesn't take down the whole networking stack. Even if UDP dies, you will still be able, or that's the ideal, you will still be able to use your TCP connections, and they will just continue to go on.
Okay, so do you then further subdivide that to a network port level? So thinking of wired Ethernet versus a Wi-Fi Ethernet?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, say you're being attacked you have a multi-home system and you're being attacked on the public internet port, and they manage to crash that. You could still continue to operate on the back end so that your management will be able to access this server.
The same principle as Jakub described on the networking level goes also to our device drivers, which also run in user space and are also decomposed. So we have a separate driver for each individual device. So yeah, even this is not so related to the networking. Even if a device driver crashes, driving one device, the other device drivers are still running, and the operating system itself is still running. And you can, for example, respawn the dead device driver and reinitialize the hardware.
This seems to be very Minix-y in its approach.
To a certain degree, I was just going to say that we are applying a similar principle to our file systems layer, where it is possible to have multiple instances of the same file system, say the FAT file system, which works or which serves the root file system, and also which serves some mounted FAT file system. You can either have it served by only one process, or you can split it into two FAT servers, and both of them serves one of these file systems. So let's say that your non-root FAT file system crashes, and you will still be able to continue to use your root FAT file system. But unlike the Minix guys, we do not do this respawning of killed processes.
So how do you recover them? Manually? Is manual intervention required?
Well, if the component that crashes is not essential to the degree that it's no longer possible to use the system after it crashes, you can still spawn new instances, or you should be, in theory, able to spawn new instances of it.
Okay, so this is a lovely project. You're students, I assume, because you're in the...
No, I'm employed. I have two kids.
So this is an attempt to rip off Google's summer of college from poor, worthy students.
No, it isn't, because we used to be Google Summer of Code mentors.
Oh, and people came onto your project and you mentored them and they went off. How successful has that been for your project?
How many students have you already had?
In Google Summer of Code, it was like 8 students in total. And the total success rate was like 70% or something like that. So obviously there were some dropouts, but otherwise the students who passed the evaluation, we were very happy with their work, and their work was integrated into our mainline development.
Okay, the Google Summer of Code is something put on by the Google Corporation to say spare students, computer students, I guess, from flipping burgers during the summer, and this is for people, listeners who may not know, and other software projects get the benefit of that. So do you two work on this, or is this a part-time job for you guys?
Well, this is my hobby project, basically. I work on it in my spare time.
And for me, it's part-time hobby work, part-time actual work, because I'm working as a computer science operating systems researcher at Charles University in Prague. So basically, I'm doing the research part of the HelenOS use.
Okay, fantastic. And has anybody using this in practice, out in the field, in industry at this point, or are we still in early development?
Well, I think it's still too early, but I would like to use Andy Tannenbaum's phrase for it, because it's a BSD license. We don't know if there is anybody who is using it or who might be using it.
Okay, guys, and if somebody's interested in joining the project, helping out, where can they go? Have you got contact to the website or something?
So that's easy. Just go to helenos.org, and there you will find anything important, including the addresses of the mailing list, our IRC channel.
Okay, links to all that will be in the show notes for this episode. I see you've got two IBM ThinkPads. What's the safest piece of hardware? I know I've installed some experimental OSs before. What's the safest piece of hardware to go and install this on if somebody wanted to have a go?
I would say it's QEMU. but other than that, it's probably the commodity PC.
Any standardized PC, enough standard PC can run HelenOS.
And do you have your own bootloader as well? Do you use Grub or Lilo or something?
We use Grub.
Okay.
Well, at least on the PC. We use some immediate bootloaders on the other architectures which we support, because Grub is very comfortable bootloader. It allows you to load multiple components, not only the kernel, which the other bootloaders on the other platforms lack. They are like this functionality. So we use the native bootloader to load a huge single binary, and then we unpack this huge single binary into the microkernel and some initial user space components that are required.
I know there's some people who will definitely be interested in downloading and trying this. Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate taking the time for this, and hopefully you'll get some interest from the HBR audience.
Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Ken again for Hacker Public Radio at In the K Building, down going around the booths, and I've come across Michael, is it? Michael?
Hi, I'm Michael from CA Cert.
And what's CA Cert?
CA-CERT is a community certificate authority. That means you can get those certificates that you use to establish an SSL connection, a secure connection to some web server, or use it to sign email messages, but you also can use, get PGP keys, yeah. And we sign those certificates, and we do that by bringing the Web of Trust that you know from PGP to the X509, the SSL world.
Okay. At your table, it's a hive of activity. There are loads of people. It looks like a scene from CSI Miami or something. There's everybody's looking at passports and driver's license with dual glasses and infrared torches and stuff. So what's going on over there?
Yeah, hopefully there's nobody dying over there. But yeah, over there we do the verification process. So if you want to include your name in your certificate, then we obviously have to verify that you are the one you are claiming to be. So we need to check your passport or your ID card or driver's license and match it to your face and to the data you're giving us.
But why are you doing that? I can just go to VeriSign or somebody and just give them my credit card details and get a cert.
Yeah, but they are A, less cool, and B, it costs money. So if you go to VeriSign, you need to give them money, and here it's everything is for free, and we are building this around the community, so it's more like open source approach, because we publish all of our source code, so you can look at what we are doing wrong on what we do right, and that you can't at VeriSign, so maybe you trust us a little bit more than VeriSign.
So if I had a website, I think the ideal use case would be I've got kenfallon.com, for instance, and I want to put up an encrypted version at https://kenfallon.com. And then I would need a top-level security certificate to so that the web browser knows, well, I trust CA-CERT, so therefore I can trust that if I go to this site, CA-CERT has verified that they are who they are. Would that be the short 1,000-foot view of what's going on here?
Yeah. The browser can check your certificate, and we can check that you are you. Yeah.
Okay. Are you already built into many browsers?
Unfortunately, no, not at the moment. We are working on that still, but it's a huge amount of work and money and everything you can think of. So we always need more helping people. We are in some of the Linux distributions, but unfortunately not in the browsers. That has some drawback that most users will see these warning signs when they visit your page on an SSL connection. Our target is that we secure all those sites that are currently not secured at all.
That's quite good. So, but even if I was using in an organization with Internet Explorer, I could still download and deploy your public key to all my clients.
Yeah, we have for Windows platforms, we have an easy installer. For all other platforms, it's still easy even without an installer. So you just download the certificate, say, yeah, I want to really import this, and click OK, and that's it.
You publish the MD5 summer that show some of that.
You can actually read it from there. I can also read it right now. The fingerprint for our root CA is, let's see which one is the SHA-1. Be prepared. I think this one is the SHA-1.
It'll be on the forum in the show notes for this episode. So what have I got here in front of me? You give me an A4 document.
Yeah.
What is this?
This is the form you have to fill out when you want to verify your identity. So when you come to a booth, you have to fill out one of these forms, and an assurer will verify that the data you're entering in this form matches your ID card, and then he will take this paper at home he will enter the data into the system and check that everything is okay. So you basically enter the name, date of birth, and email address, not that many data, and you have to agree to the CSO community agreement, and that's it.
And what's covered in that community agreement?
Yeah, we have to, unlike GPG, where you can, where everything is, well, more anarchic, in CSO we have certain rules that you have to follow. And if you don't adhere to these rules, you can be held liable. So that's to build more trust in the process, because if you have no liability at all, then you can basically do anything, or no one is held accountable. So what you do here is to set up these rules and set up the accountability thing. We have an internal dispute resolution policy that you can file if anything goes wrong in the process. Somebody can file a dispute, and then we will handle out the stuff and make sure that the result is now.
Fair, I guess. Yeah.
Fair, yeah.
Yep. So I suppose, if you know that you're going to an event where CA Cert is going to be at, you could read this policy prior to coming to the event, I guess. What else would I need to bring with me?
Yeah, you would need at least one government-issued photo ID card. So a passport, driver's license, or anything in that direction. And ideally another document, and that's it. If you want to, you can create your account before coming to an event and print out some pre-filled forms in your account, so that you don't have to fill out each form by hand, and it's much more readable for us. But that's it.
Okay. Pretty cool. And who determines who the volunteers are? How do you vet the people who are examining these certs?
Once you have got enough assurances, once you have verified your identity often enough, you yourself become an assurer. You get enough trust points, and then you make a small multiple choice online test. And then if you pass the test, you are an insurer and part of the community that that verifies the identity of other people.
And how would I go about doing that? What more can I do? I bring a passport and driver's license to you, I get my cert, then what else do I have to do?
Sorry, can you...
How would I become an assurer?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get those additional points?
Oh, you go to multiple people. You don't fill out one form. You have to fill out four forms or something like that, and you go to multiple people, and each one verifies your identity, so that more eyes have seen your documents, and if there are errors, more people are able to spot them at least, and so you gain some more trust by repeating the process. And after that, you have enough points, basically.
And are you allowed to verify this by yourself, or is there always a policy of having multiple CA certifiers, multiple verifying people?
It's okay if you just meet two people meet to do the assurance. That's perfectly okay, and in some areas, it's the only way it's feasible. But you have to do multiple assurances in total, because you have to go to different meeting points.
Okay, gotcha. That's absolutely fantastic. So the view, of course, is you're going to try and get this into more browsers going forward and stuff. Have you met any objections from other security companies or not?
Objections? I think they don't regard us as a real threat yet, because we are not in the browsers yet.
Okay.
So there no, I don't know of any major problems there.
I don't really see a reason why Mozilla, for instance, wouldn't put your CA search into the browser.
Yeah, that's because for the browser vendors to integrate a certificate into their browser, you have to do a security audit over your whole system. Yeah. And we have begun an audit over our registration authority. That means the identity verification part, and it seems that it would be auditable, but the systems part is something we have to figure out yet. So we are working on that, and once we have that in order, we can begin a proper audit.
And how many people have been certified?
Oh, I don't know really. I think it's something like 3,000 users or something, but I don't know the number from top. What I can say is that I think last week, so 2 weeks ago, we had the 1 millionth certificate signed.
Wow, cool, congratulations. Okay, Michael, is there anything else I missed or that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, come to our booth, assure others, bring the CA Cert community to all parts of the world.
Do you, if people, a lot of our listeners go to a lot of different events, is there a place that we can find out if you're going to be at that fest or not, or if they would like to get somebody to come to that fest? How are we going to go about that?
We have a wiki where we organize the event section. There you can have a look, and also some days or weeks before the event, we will also usually do a blog post. So if you subscribe to our RSS feed from the blog or something, then you probably get notice when there's an event around your area.
Okay, perfect. Links to all that information will be in the show notes for this episode. Michael, thank you very much for taking the time, and tune in for another exciting episode of Hacker Public Radio.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license. You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.